I think that my job is to start a conversation and discussion about something I really care about, which is massive stars evolution, but most importantly for this workshop, the uncertainties that prevent us or allow us, actually, in this case, to get the rates for LIGO. And so we heard a lot of different models that make use of different kind of physics. And depending on the kind of physics and the way we implement it in the models, we get differing outcomes. And I think that there's a number of things that this is that it's important to be done. And I think the first one is list what are the most important uncertainties that play a role in determining what's the final outcome of massive star. I think we heard this morning that mass loss, especially in the Wolf-Rayet phase, are still a matter of discussion. So these are line-driven winds, which I want to remind you are the ones that are supposed to be understood. So the one where we understand the physical mechanism. Yet, I think that due to uncertain physics, like clumping, are still uncertain within a factor of a few. And still, their metallicity dependency seems to be need to be certainly firmly like determined. But the important point is that for stars that do not go directly to the Wolf-Rayet phase, those stars become giant stars, and those giant stars tend to have winds which can be extremely intense, or even eruptive mass loss, and those are not only not understood quantitatively, but at this point not even qualitatively. So we don't know what's the mechanism that drives potentially the largest amount of mass which is lost by a star, a massive star during its lifetime. So mass loss, I believe, it's an important, or mostly probably the most important player into the evolution of these massive stars. Energy transport, this came up in discussion, I think, also when people have been discussing common envelope, which we'll get to in a second. Energy transport in the outer layers of massive radiation-dominated stars is difficult. The MLT formulation, which is used in the 1D codes, breaks down. So the radii of the stars, which as you know very well, are important outcomes to determine if the star is going to interact and when it's going to do it, also uncertain. Internal mixing. Very important point for all the models that want, for example, to have stars remaining compact. Internal mixing of elements lead to potentially to chemical homogeneous evolution. So how efficient is internal mixing? What's really driving it? Is this rotationally induced? I think we're still debating in the community if that's the case and how that actually works. When you go to lower mass stars, internal mixing is also not very well understood, as, for example, showed by the transport of angular momentum, which is another important player. For example, if you want to understand what's the final spin of the black hole you're going to merge, that's something that potentially LIGO can put constraints on. And so, again, I think that it's been discussed in previous talks. Maybe there's been a little bit of perception like this is understood physics. Let me remind you, this is not. So Stan gave a very good talk, and he talked about the final spins and final outcome of models. I would say that he didn't stress enough the fact that this is for a certain set of physics which is implemented in the model. And this physics, when taken to stars where we can actually measure the internal rotation profile as the star evolves, give you results which are at least a factor of 10 away from the observation. This result comes from lower mass stars from astroseismology. For stars that are interacting, of course, common envelope, it's a very important player. The physics of common envelope, as we heard, is uncertain, so we need to understand that better if you want to come up with a substantial understanding of the rates that come out. Other players or things that can enter this calculation, the kicks, physics of pulsational perinstability supernovae, black hole formation, and so on and so forth. So I don't want to talk much more. I just put it out a couple of questions. The first question that came to my mind from the perspective of somebody who's doing stellar evolution and stellar physics is, you know, there's a lot there. We need to pick our battle. So what are the important things, the one we want to tackle first, and the one where we can both have maybe observational constraints, that can help us to do a better job in tweaking the models in the right direction. And also, so if we need to make some improvement in the next few years as LIGO start producing more observation, what are the low-hanging fruits from the computational point of view on which the community can work on so that we can do a better job and maybe even get down to breaking down the degeneracy in the model so that we can start realizing which channels are actually contributing the most to the LIGO detection rate. So it's your pick. We can start from that. I just wanted to say that at some point, Lydia wants to give us a little overview of some of the observational constraints that we can have, for example, for the problem internal mixing. So she has some interesting work that she wants to tell us about. So at some point, she will take the floor and discuss that too. But I guess I would love to hear from you. What's your opinion? I mean, to me, mass loss is really one of those big questions that need to be addressed. And I don't know if you have ideas on how we could go about doing that.
So I wanted to ask, Wolf gave briefly mentioned the possibility of doing 3D hydro with radiative transport to mold these things. So I wonder, is our understanding of the physics good enough that we could do a self-consistent simulation of mass loss and believe the results?
Difficult question. I mean, 3D modeling with full non-LTE time dependent is out of the reach, clearly. What one can try to include, so to say, parameterized 3D effects, like the change of opacity by inhomogeneous structures, introduce some effective opacity also. That's the way how we try to include this into 1D hydrodynamical models. That's the only chance. But of course, then you need empirical tests to calibrate some free parameters which you have. I mentioned, for instance, the microturbulence, which is not well understood where microturbulence comes from. And there's very little handle to measure it in a stellar wind. You see the wind, but what you need for consistent hydrodynamics is a microturbulence at the critical point, and that is can probably not see it. So there will be always a need to calibrate constants. There will be no fully consistent model from first principles, as far as I can see.
And in terms of these calibrations, I guess we have this issue that we have the Galaxy, the LMC, and the SMC to actually measure these things. Will we be able to measure something deeper than that in any recent time? Or?
Yeah, I would say that the nearby universe is bigger than that. We will definitely have more galaxies to test it. And I want to say, to calibrate the theory, we have minimum two observational constraints. That is the mass loss rate and the wind velocity, which must also come out correctly.
To your question, I want to say that we soon will lose ability to study even galaxy SMC and LMC because we really desperately need new UV spectrograph. Stellar mass loss rates are measured in UV. NASA people here or ESO people here? Nothing in horizon. And this is, I mean, not only for massive stars, for quasar community, it is really.
Other calibration or the other constraint on mass loss is just integrated population. So if you take the inferred mass loss rates that you're getting from the Wolf-Rayet stars, use those in models, can you actually reproduce the population of Wolf-Rayet stars in the SMC, LMC galaxy? I mean, I think if I understood correctly, you said in the SMC, you need the chemically homogeneous evolution, perhaps, except they're not rotating fast, so that seemed weird. or inconsistent, depending. So what about in the Milky Way?
Yeah, okay, you're right. So we did this for the Milky Way with population synthesis. And so far, there is no set of evolutionary tracks which is really satisfactory. We didn't repeat this exercise yet for the small Magellanic Cloud. Anyhow, it will be small number statistics. But once you check it with the homogeneous evolution tracks, for instance.
Yeah, and I guess once you put in binaries, it becomes much harder to go from model to observations. Yeah, but you don't really know if those single stars are actual single stars, or whether or not they had a binary history behind them. Well, I mean, you can essentially strip any star, so you can produce helium stars all the way down to nothing. So just by having single stars, you have a threshold where the wind manages to strip the star and create a Wolf Rayet. But the binaries mess that up. Yeah, well, I think, well, maybe someone can give a...
Oh, sorry. So the first thing to realize when you look at these tracks, there's also the fast evolutionary phases. So just seeing where they go is really misleading in doing this population synthesis experiment that you propose. J.J. Eldredge has been populating this... So yes, you can do that. It's just the plots we see so far, you have to be really careful by. So J.J. Eldredge at least has been populating this diagram with density distributions where they expect them. They looked pretty okay. I think maybe somebody remembers that paper better than that. You showed some of his binary tracks. So they cover that part of the diagram, and then there's a story that there are big selection effects that come in at that point, because the highest mass Wolf Rayet stars, they really have typical Wolf Rayet emission lines, and you might be able to see them easily in a 10-day binary or a 100-day binary. If you go to the lower masses, so at some point we don't see these helium stars. Why? Binaries would produce them all over the place, right? Well, the SMC is actually relatively young, maybe that's part of the story, but at some point also these stars become lower and lower mass, don't have these emission lines. And so all you would see at best is a star that seems to be pretty single, or maybe is a single line binary. And so my feeling is at least that there's a lot of these lower mass helium stars hiding if you would go to lower masses that look like a normal main sequence star, because their main sequence stars are outshining. So that these are big challenges when you want to do this study. So one of the things in my group we're trying is to see what are the observational predictions for these lower mass helium stars. We're trying to call them baby Wolf Rayet stars to indicate that they're really not Wolf Rayet stars as we think of them. They're also not pure helium stars. They have features we can look for, but we have never systematically looked for them. So that would be a way to circumvent, at least get some probes in that area of the diagram. And the other way to do this is, I think, what J.J. Eldredge did. Maybe it's not bad to put a something to put a plot on there. Do you have something?
But I don't agree about this hidden helium stars. I mean, when a star is a helium star, then it has a higher luminosity compared to its mass, then it will develop emission lines. And emission line stars are easily to spot. Even when they are in a binary, which is often the case, binary, say, with an O star, the O star might be 10 times brighter, but still the emission lines are popping out on the spectrum. And the usual way how people making surveys
is that they're taking images with narrowband filter on a most prominent emission line, compared it with wideband photometry, and you easily can get a complete census of emission line stars, including what you say, lurking helium stars.
If they're strong enough, yes, but they get weaker and weaker. If the 3 or 4 solar mass helium stars are still pretty bright, it would be pretty narrow emission lines. Probably the winds are less strong. I don't think we have done a systematic study for this weaker components, but if you feel different, we can discuss that too also.
So this lower mass helium star are an interesting test, but will we be able, going back to the issue of missing UV instruments, when will we be able to see any of this? So I think we don't have anything in decades or so that might.
No, they have emission lines in the optical you can look for.
In optical you have enough, okay.
It's a great shame there's not a UV telescope soon out there taking good spectra. That's a big worry.
Okay. So we talked about line-driven winds. Sorry, Rico?
I just had a question for you.
Oh, yeah. Sure, no, go ahead.
So you mentioned that if you use the same prescriptions for transport angular momentum, you get the low mass incorrectly.
That's correct.
I mean, there's also constraints based on the rotational periods of pulsars.
Yeah.
So is there a prescription that can actually be effective at both?
No. So Enrico is referring to the fact that people have been calibrating a prescription for internal angular momentum transport from the massive star side, basically looking at the spin rate of the final remnant, comparing to young pulsars, and that can be done. And people usually came down to preferring way to transport angular momentum inside star that utilize the presence of magnetic field as produced in relative zone by so-called Sproot-Taylor dynamo mechanism. I won't go into the details. The magnetic field works as a rubber band and can connect the core and the envelope, basically. So you end up spinning down the core of the final remnant as the star loses mass through the envelope, and especially as the envelope expands due to the larger inertia. And you obtain rotation rate of the core of this compact remnant, which are like both for white dwarf and neutron star, within a factor of 10 over the observations. From the lower mass stars, from master seismology, we have more exquisite data using basically modes of oscillation that probe the inner region of the star. We can measure, as the star evolves on the giant branch, the rotation rate of the core. And there you can do a very, very good job in trying to follow the evolutionary track and compare it of the rotation rate of the core, if you want, as the star evolves, compare it to the prediction and the observation for thousands of stars. And if you do that, you find out that this prescription that's been used for massive stars cannot recover the observation, and they're off by a factor of 10. The core rotates slower than it predicted by the Taylor-Sproot dynamo mechanism. Correct, which is surprising because people have been said, oh, you know, in massive stars, this is even maybe too strong or whatever compared to what people used to do before, which is just allowing for angular momentum transport by rotationally induced instabilities. So this seems to be a strong message for the massive star community that we shouldn't trust too much what we have for angular momentum transport inside stars.
So, to be very clear, that means you should not trust the predictions of Earth's
spins. Absolutely not.
Actually, that could be too high.
Could be anything.
Well,
we don't know.
Well, I mean, if you're just collapsing everything into the black hole, then you don't care about the transport.
Right, but the angular momentum that you have inside the star at that point depends also on the previous history.
Yes, yes. So.
You're right. I think that is there really is a large regime of direct black hole.
Yeah. Right. Also, especially if you evolved as a chemical homogeneous star, where you probably didn't lose too much mass, that story it's kind of neat. But for all the usual average stars, that is a different story.
So I was wondering, I mean, it's amazing work. Can you give us a feeling how strong that statement is, or is there some degeneracy or wiggle room?
No, it's, I would say that for the low-mass stars, this is a very well-established result, has been proved to be correct for a large fraction of the stars observed. This comes from a very simple observation of splitting of lines. So, you know, you're, if you, this is basically waves that penetrate into the core and other that do not do that. So you can measure the average splitting of stuff that stays in the envelope and the average splitting of wave that penetrates into the core. And you basically, you measure the splitting and you get the rotation rate.
Wait, there is huge wiggle room on the theory side.
Yes.
It gives prescriptions for magnetic diamonds and K-free parameters and uncertainty. So it could be that there's that the underlying theory is in the right direction, but just there are uncertainties in some of these
constants. That's definitely a possibility. So there's a lot of work. I think that's something to be aware in this community, that a lot of work that is going on the lower mass side of the spectrum of stars for trying to constrain this kind of observation. So I think there's a lot going on there, and I believe there will be soon better prescription that will maybe we can import and start running our models considering those.
But you mentioned white dwarfs constraints. Are the low mass, high mass enough that you can start constraining, comparing your rotation rate of the core with those of white?
Yeah, so, the story gets a little complicated. So this test of Angle-Winton transport that we're talking about is done on the giant branch, as I start to climb the right giant branch. Then there are other phases of evolution after that, where Angle-Winton can be transported again in different ways. The final outcome that you get, so the white dwarf spin rate, it's a result of a complex integrated story of Angle-Winton transport. Now, with the Sprute-Taylor models, you can get those values right within a factor of 10. You do a decent job, but you don't know if you do it right because, you know, somewhere you did a bad job, so you underestimated the Angle-Winton transport. At another phase of evolution, you overestimated it.
So when you say factor of 10, that's
what? And spin rate. Usually it's slightly too high, if I remember correctly.
So your argument is that they were not efficient enough.
Correct.
But then they have to slow down at the stage of producing the white dwarf.
My argument is that in general, all the prescription I've been using so far seems to underestimate the efficiency of Angle-Winton transport in stars, period.
Very much transport afterwards if you want to get the white dwarf spins to be hours, right? You can't lose a lot more in the AGB phase.
Right, what I'm saying is that there might be phases later on where Angle-Winton transport becomes less efficient for some reason.
Right, but I'm just saying that probably has to happen, right? I mean, the Sprute-Taylor predicts the red giants have cores that are rotating too fast compared to the observations.
Yeah.
But the observations, if you ask about the inner 0.6 solar masses,
I think the discrepancy might ultimately, this tension that you talk about, to me, it's most likely due to the fact that you have a much finer comparison to the red giant branch, and you have a much broader ballpark comparison on the white dwarf regime. So when I run a model with Taylor Sprute on the red giant, I missed the data by a factor of 10. When I get down to the white dwarf, I'm around the values by a factor of 10, which usually is being considered much better than what was done in the past, because before people were off by a factor of 100 or 1,000. So when they got within a factor of 10, they were kind of claiming victory. But now, since you have this very precise way to measure rotational rate to a red giant, you even see that the slope that you get is not the right one as the star evolves. So that tells you that the physics you're implementing is not the right one. I don't know if this makes sense.
But I'm just saying, if you just take the observations and ask how much angular momentum there is in the central 0.6 in the giant branch, I think you can't take very much more out of it and still be consistent with the white dwarfs. I mean, that was sort of the surprise, right? You can't make the AGB evolution be much more dramatic.
Oh, yeah, yeah, no. During the AGB, there's probably
giant
no...
giant phase has to be more dramatic with the AGB
correct,
phase.
Correct, correct. Absolutely. Yes, I agree with that. Yes. Good point. Okay, so I think we touched through mass loss and internal angular momentum transport. For internal angular momentum transport, something that I don't know if it's worth mentioning as well, but there's also new ideas on how to spin up or spin down even, like the core of the star as a star transit to the latest phase of evolution, thanks to internal gravity waves. This is stuff that we've been doing with Elliot and Jim Fuller. So there might be some stochastic as well component into spinning down or up the final remnant, at least for the traditional values of rotation rate. Probably not true if the star is already spinning the core very, very fast. This might be another interesting ingredient that usually not included in the models. And the energy transport, we discussed that. That's also very important, you know, if you want to understand the structure of your very massive stars, these outer regions become dominated by radiation, so very important to treat convection in the right way, and MLT is definitely not the right way. So going back to the observational constraint, I think now we can maybe have Lydia talk a little bit about the work that she thinks can be useful to constrain some of the internal mixing. Yes, I'll bring this down. And I'll give you the mic.
Thank So, talking about observational constraints, I start with showing pretty picture because this pretty picture will play a role in my talk because I'll talk about this star here a lot, and this star also appeared in Wolf Rainer's talk. So this is based on our spectroscopic survey of Wink of the small Magellanic cloud. And I'm going basically to present some results from paper, which is hopefully to be submitted soon, where we are going to put observational properties on merger massive black holes progenitors. Of course, I cannot talk about the whole thing. So the idea behind this is that now we have at least two models, one by Pablo, another one we're also checking common evolution models by New Zealand group, by Eldridge group, but here, because Pablo is sitting just here, I will present only work which is based on his results. So Pablo and collaborators published a paper where they presented evolutionary tracks of possible gravitational wave progenitors, and we asked the simple questions: do such stars exist in present-day universe? Is it realistic in any way? So we contacted the Bond group, and Pablo very kindly provided us with his tracks. So, and these tracks are, these tracks are shown here. So the tracks are of two stars, which are very quickly exchange mass, as Pablo knows better than everybody else in this room. So we have two tracks for 50 solar mass, for 60 solar mass stars. I will explain here just one case of this. And we also, I will also concentrate here only on 1/10 of solar metallicity, just to be quick. So what we do basically, we take key evolutionary stages, so main sequence, some turnoff from main sequence, and final evolutionary stages. We use calculate synthetic spectra of such stars, and we compare them with observations just to see do such stars exist or not. And we also can say a couple of words about feedback. And the color-coded diagram is the same what was shown in the talk this morning. So is idea clear?
How reliable are those calculations?
Very reliable. I mean, very reliable. This is because we have this. Tool, which is non-LTR model atmospheres, and which has millions of atoms, include metals, and of course, I mean, mouse to full yard. This spherically symmetric situation, and it's one-zero radiative transfer. But atomic physics, we try to include it as good as we can. Yeah. Yeah, it is a parameter, yeah. But not in this case. In this case, we take m dot as he gives us. So, because to calculate this evolution, it tracks your input m dot, right, as we discussed just now. So now we take m dot as he gives us, and we just calculate, you know, very simple exercise. Do such stars exist? Right? And even then, because we take, so in this just now short presentation, I take only 1/10 solar abundances. But even in this case, this table which you cannot read, it doesn't matter that we include all elements with many, many levels, just to be back to your question, how reliable are these predictions? So we are not mean here. We include as much as we can. And this is the result. So this is Pablo HR diagram. And so we take 5 key evolutionary stages, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the time goes in this plot from zero H main sequence to pre-collapse. And what we see here, so time increases from top to bottom, and this is optical spectrum from 3000 till 7000. This is synthetic spectrum, right? So this is 63 solar mass down zero H main sequence, and it's pretty much dominated by absorption lines. And then the star evolves, it becomes, even in optical, it becomes a very strong emission line star. So we are not talking about Milky Way here because we're starting this probing SMC exactly. So I'm getting to it. Yeah, I'm getting to it. So that's. But of course, it's not only the problem. Do we really are capable to detect like exact progenitors? There's more broad question: are such stars exist with similar properties? Are these evidence for homogeneous, for instance, yeah. Right, so it's going from, so important point going to our previous discussion this morning, important point here, this is an optical. Helium to helium to helium to helium to helium to helium, 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 helium. So where are the metals? This little nitrogen here. And so, useless. Therefore, we go now to UV. So, phosphorus, carbon, silicon, phosphorus, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, silicon, so, nitrogen. We need UV. So, and now, again, so the same spectra evolving from main sequence to ultraviolet stage, and this is our spectral evolutionary sequence. So we start with O3 dwarf, go on to O2-3 or supergiant, WN late type star, and final WO1 type star, whom nobody saw so far. So question mark here, it's a new spectral type. And that's how mass loss rates change. So this is synthetic spectral, so they look very much like observed spectral. They are synthetic spectral, therefore, mass loss rate is as provided by evolutionary models. But we played a bit, so we changed slightly here description for mass loss rates too. Okay. Now, a couple of words about stellar feedback. This is galactic area on sky around WO type star, galactic WO type star, which is called W142. But in this evolution, so when we look here, I didn't plot here velocities. So Pablo doesn't give us velocities, wind velocities. So wind velocity, you don't, I think. So wind velocities we get ourselves based on our prescriptions of hydrodynamics and stellar winds. I don't put here velocities, but they're remarkable, at least at substages. So with such massless rates and such velocities in excess of 2,000, and sometimes in some important stages go to 5,000, 6,000 kilometers a second, yeah, we are getting really a huge kinetic energy. And why I'm showing here this picture, because even a galaxy, such star, which is with initial mass, say, 40, 60, it gives our energy input on scale of million years, which is comparable to supernova. So maybe it is not for this community, but for people who do galaxy simulations, you cannot ignore massive stars. You cannot put all feedback only from supernova, because those are important. Okay, I mean, instantaneous, of course, from supernova, but yeah, this is also an interesting number to remember for extragalactic people and also for people who observe emission line galaxies or early type galaxies with H2 regions and try to infer stellar population from observed fluxes. So now, as I promised, back to this pretty picture. So this is HST image with this object here, SK183. And it turned out that it has absolutely the same spectral type as stars which are predicted by Pablo evolutionary calculations. And now I'm not talking about our synthetic spectrum. Now I'm talking about real star which is sitting on sky in the SMC. So this is its optical observations, and this is the whole SED spectral energy distribution from UV to infrared, and blue observations and red is our model. So now we model real spectra. So the star sitting here, it's a zero H main sequence star. The key point here is that it has nitrogen enhanced by order of magnitude compared to Small Magellanic Clouds nitrogen. So, and enhanced nitrogen and normal carbon and oxygen is direct evidence of rotational mixing. And this is not only one peculiar star, so this is well-known result that very massive stars, all stars in the SMC, they show strong evidence for homogeneous, chemically homogeneous evolution.
What is normal signature? You would expect carbon depletion theory. I mean, the nitrogen has to come from somewhere.
Okay. Good point, yeah. Yeah. So, enhanced nitrogen. I know rotation rate for the star. So, this table here compares observations with evolutionary model predictions on zero H main sequence. So, ta-da, not surprising. So this is from Pablo models. He starts from 380 kilometers a second. Of course, from this guy here, we have no idea of sine I. And this is a binary, which means that it will be not make merging black holes, because component is presumably, I don't know, maybe B-type star. So it's not identical like O35 plus O35, no. But the point here is that the similar object exist, would they make binaries later on which would merge? So would other stars of the type be in binaries? That's already a different question. But the key point which I would like to attract your attention here is this line here. So look, an evolutionary model to produce such star, you need metallicity 1/10 solar with massless rate 10 to minus 6. In real star on sky, we have metallicity 0.2 solar and minus massless rate, which is empirically derived order of magnitude lower. So in the framework of workshop, I would like to just pose very serious question. Maybe you don't need to go to such low metallicities. It's all, again, you know, discussion session outside. It's perfectly feasible and in local galaxies, even with SMC metallicities, maybe even overestimate massless right here. I think that's about it. About spins. So this is our nice plot, which shows 9 black hole systems with measured spins. So 9 points here, and they're color-coded. So the red ones are low mass X-ray binaries with donor stars, which are red stars. And only 3 black holes with measured spin come from early with massive star components, which are wind-fed. And as you can see, they are sitting pretty high here. So with LIGO spins measured, which are significantly below. So interesting question. Can this galactic black hole systems with early type donors be considered as progenitors of gravitational wave progenitors? Ah, yeah, and just a word about your Lexis. So when I take this final evolutionary stage, not even going to extreme W or, yeah, just take normal WN2 star, say, in the SMC, and calculate how what would be its X-ray radiation when it accretes its wind accretion without Roche-Low power flow. On a modest black hole with 30 solar masses, I just get ULX luminosity without doing even on a relatively wide orbit, because just not because of massless rate, because of wind speed. Do I say it correctly? Okay, say wind power, right? So that's it. Thank you.
So I was struck by your mass loss rate determination, because to my understanding, Pablo and us, and we all use empirically calibrated mass loss rate recipes, I thought. I don't know exactly which mass loss rates you put in, but a factor of 10 lower in that regime, even though you are already at lower metallicity, so what would it be? Like almost a factor 15 or 20 lower than the... so you have a factor of 15 or 20 higher than the...
In my support, I must say only that this is empirically derived massless rate, which pretty well agree with massless rate derived by other groups are for similar stars. Mm-hmm.
So, well, one thing is that we use the empirically derived laws for galactic stars, so it's a high description. But we poke in front of it the O star metallicity scaling. So, for instance, if you have something like what we saw in the morning, that the scaling with metallicity is much steeper, then you also would expect a much faster drop of mass loss rates.
Black hole binaries, you want the radius, not to change too much, right? You don't want radius expansion. Is that dependent mainly on the wind, or is that dependent on the opacities inside? In other words, does changing the mass loss fix it, or do you need the low metallicities to get the star to evolve?
So I guess that convolves with the question of inflation of envelopes. So at some point, if you go too high in metallicity, you will have too much iron, and that's too opaque. So your envelopes in 1D codes, at least, try to expand crazily, even for Wolf-Rayet stars. So I guess if I would just try to model that with 1D codes for very high metallicity, just forcing the mass loss down, I would get crazy amounts of overflow, which wouldn't work. So for the SMC, it doesn't turn out to be big enough. I think you have to go close to galactic for that to be an issue.
But just to make some final concluding remark, it seems to me that what Rana said earlier this morning from analysis of WR stars in the SMC, and when I prepared this very short presentation, I also looked at previous literature, it seems to me
that there is a consensus that at SMC metallicities, most massive stars are evolving chemically homogeneous. So empiric evidence.
To conclude with that, I think the point is we should be consistent. Yeah. So your assumptions on mass loss should be consistent with the observations. That was what I was talking about. You were taking an old recipe from me even, but since then we have revised the mass loss rates down a little bit, and one should see whether it still works with your scenario. And at the end, hopefully, it should be consistent to, with the observations, at least for the SMC.
So that was goes back to what Stel was mentioning about what comes into the model. Is it the wind mass loss or the opacities or whatever? So the thing is that if the actual mass loss rates change significantly, I would expect this to be compensated by a change in metallicity. So you would be moving where your progenitors are, but things would still be working. So that is important for rate calculations, I think. But in terms of this happening, the effective mass loss rates are not that important in the end, I think. They're very important to get proper estimates, but not to constrain if this happens. Yeah.
Basically, that would have to be a mass.
Yeah.
So, Lydia, I think that you made a very interesting statement, which is that it is just well known that the high mass stars in the SMC are product of homogeneous chemical evolution. And I didn't know that. And so, can you just tell me what the empirical, you know, is it because of from the abundances that one says this, or is it, you know, is it really the abundance patterns, and it's, or is it just high nitrogen, and or is it high nitrogen plus low carbon, or what is it that's making you so confident about that statement?
Okay, one should not be overconfident, of course. So we are talking about only, to my knowledge, in this mass range. So the stars which are more massive than 50 solar. There are only four stars known in the SMC. So of these four, three were analyzed. And also, okay, there were other two stars analyzed in lower mass beams, so with maybe 20, 30, but both analysis of independent codes and independent groups show the same pattern, basically enhanced composition of nitrogen. Interestingly, so of course, less massive stars, A and B type stars, which are much more common, of course, in the SMC, they show SMC abundances of nitrogen. So, and then people also studied fast rotating, for instance, BE stars in the SMC, and they do not exactly see this. I mean, I'm afraid to say something wrong here, but from memory, they don't see enhanced nitrogen in B stars in the SMC. Okay, but bottom line here is that only upper, most massive stars in the SMC that shows this nitrogen abundance enhancement, and B-type stars seems to be have average SMC abundances.
Okay, most stars present plus the W, half stars I was talking about in the one.
And the absence of
So, well, I would be careful about saying nitrogen enrichment means chemically homogeneous evolution, because it just means you went deep enough in the star somehow. So it can be massless. So plenty of people say, I think Götz-Grafner says, like, massless solves everything. Huh? Yes. So,
not
yeah, so I guess that one is hard to make with mass loss.
I mean, it might be
must not be homogeneous.
No, but I mean just to get nitrogen on the top, you don't even need to mix what's in the core. You have plenty of CNO process material in the envelope itself as well. For all SAS as well.
Okay, I just saw that Juno was here, so I wanted to. I mean, you made a very interesting point about, you know, if these progenitors exist to give rise to this type of sources, and when you actually looked at the optimistic LIGO rate, which is 1% of the core collapse rate, which is pretty scary, can you learn anything about whether or not this population of objects exist in the early universe by just looking at the integrated UV luminosity calorimetry on galaxies? Or?
Well, so I love this channel because it gives you these funky abundant these line ratios that you're seeing at redshift 2. It gets me more ionizing photons at redshift 0. So I mean, you know, it's like everybody's. I mean, it's just like a tooth fairy that just keeps on giving, you know? But the question is it happening? And to what degree is it happening? So I think that there's indirect evidence at high redshift from, the infrared spectra, things like MOSDEF and the KBSS are finding these high line ratios that are consistent. You know, at some level, what you produce is sort of hot black bodies, right? And so hotter than just normal at these metallicities. So the mass metallicity relation is going down, you have more low metallicity galaxies at redshift 2, you have more of this channel, right? I think at redshift and at redshift 0, I think the tricky part is that how degenerate is that with other things? And I think we have, at least in the local universe, there's some chance to use, okay, so, you know, we just had the three stars in the SMC and a lack of a red giant branch, right? So, okay, that, you know, I mean, that's, it's consistent with, but hardly, you know, the like final stamp of like this is happening. Because as Pablo said, yeah, you know, are the chemical abundance ratios really the nail in the coffin that's telling you this? Like, for example, if you have, now you want to start talking about ester seismology in the SMC, like then I feel like you can start to get more constraints. So I mean, I think a lot of these issues are going to be resolved locally, but I do think that there's a number of things in the high redshift universe. And you want to talk about reionization. It's just that the degeneracies don't go up just because you have less data, right? The degeneracies don't go down just because the data sets become more incomplete. It just means that more things are plausible, right? So right now, getting these higher cues are really nice for these infrared spectra. And for reionization, but they're not necessary.
But for example, if Pablo gives you a population synthesis that produces the right number of these mergers, you're producing tons of other things that don't merge that have tons of UV light. And then is the integrated light at all something that can be used to constrain?
Right, so it'll trade off with what you're producing in the galaxy and then what's getting out of the galaxy. So that becomes it's that product that you're constraining. Okay, so like I said, you know, in the local universe, there's some hope of actually measuring those components individually. At high redshift, you're just doing the integral, and you can get that in a few different ways. But I do think that you're going to have, you know, how many times do you, you know, so Selma said the other day, you know, we wanted to produce GRBs, right? Wasn't Selma and Mateo, we're trying to produce some GRBs, right? So what is the GRB rate? Yeah, you. And so, you know, right, so, you know, so you kind of, I mean, it's sort of a messy astronomy situation where you have a whole bunch of different independent dirty tracers that are kind of giving you an integrated picture, whereas we all look at the LIGO, A, and it's just, that's what it is. It's so beautiful. I mean, it's just gravity, right? So that's easier than all this other crap that we have to deal with. But anyway, our stuff is pretty.
Okay, so I think we did a good job on the observational constraint. I want to use the last 10 minutes maybe to talk a little bit about what might be the computational low-hanging fruits, so what are the battles that the numerical community could take, you know, to tackle some of this overarching problems that we have into dealing with these beasts.
Well, so I think one of the frustrations is this sort of knob frustration, right? And so this has been the case for, you know, decades in the sort of semi-analytic galaxy formation community world forever. But to what degree do you guys just have produced sort of grid, you know, very, very uniform grids in all of these different parameters that you can change, that you can actually analyze? I mean, what is the status of that? That seems sort of brain dead. You could just let a computer somewhere do it and come back in a little while, but. Well, so that's, I mean, that's not totally fair, right? Because they're not, 100 don't matter as much.
Two objects, 10 parameters.
Well, so I think to some degree I can work with the knobs, and I think it's not obviously not to the degree that the rapid population synthesis does it, but I think you can do a pretty nice exploration of the parameter space and see how much you can modify things. My guess is that, like I was saying, in terms of mass loss rates, you will just be moving things in metallicity. So that's one degeneracy. I think the strongest one might be the efficiency of mixing. So perhaps.
Because as you said, if you're just taking stuff up a little bit from the core, you're not fully mixing it, that has to manifest in terms of your chemical signature.
Well, the mixing comes early on. It's usually the mass loss kicks later on in the evolution as the star becomes more and more bright. So I think there are slightly decoupled problems in that sense. So.
Yeah, but I think Yuna is right that in general, the problem with the massive, very massive stars is this degeneracy of phenomena, all extreme, that make it very hard to disentangle what kind of physics is at play. So mixing massless and potentially rotational mixing, you know, all kind of things come to interplay. The convective core is very large, might be unstable. So there's all sorts of things that make it particularly hard. So I think that either there's a sweet spot in the massive star regime where we can start doing that kind of estimates, or really going to lower mass and learn more and come back. It's also a good idea, I think.
To what extent are you worried that energy transport and mixing might depend on convection and depend on opacities that are different for 0.05 solar rather than 0.5 or 0.25 solar, right? Because we don't actually have very many observational diagnostics below SFC, so if any of this stuff, things that depend on the metallicity in some indirect way,
right. Yeah, that adds up to the fact that, you know, this, you know, your internal structure might already be not correct in the way we calculate it because we're using MLT in the other layers. Now add to that that maybe your opacity is off, then things become complicated to treat.
I think it's also quite useful to continue look for star clusters because we have there a very well defined environment, let's say, just a large number of stars which have formed under similar conditions and an ensemble, you know, there's no less observational biases as is compared to the field where we have many different generations, you know, and uncertain histories of any individual star. In a star cluster, we should much more, I mean, just my results in the morning were quite sketchy. I mean, I wish I had already much more looked in the data, but we need more data from different models. Just look on constraints for pulsars, for exotic objects, X-ray binaries, and that there are many more things which can be compared just to see that the model is correct. Yeah, so that's, I think, would.
Right? And so I think that's where there's a lot to be, you know, there's a lot of observations to
I have a question to you, if I may. It goes to this point about kicks. It seems that in our massive star community is now kind of people more or less agree that at some mass range, stars may simply implode. So they just quietly collapse. So how would it change with you when you have, like, in some mass loss range, very modest kicks?
Well, we have some preliminary parameter study. I just forget exactly how much, but reducing the kick such that we retain exactly the required number of neutron stars. But that's certainly not, this is just the first idea, yeah? I mean, it will probably follow then the next generation of Fairley's BSE or other ideas how to make a reasonable physical modeling. Rather not varying the 100 parameters, but let's say you discuss and judge about the most reasonable modeling, maybe a few small variations, and then look at the results. And even, well, if then there is a big simulation and at the end the result is not so good, we just report it, I mean, as I did about the neutron stars.
Yes.
You say that more globular clusters would help. Do you mean finding more or studying in more details the samples that already exist?
I mean, my intention certainly is doing many more models, just the different mass and rotation and all the parameters, and I'm looking at the extragalactic globular clusters. We have already, I mean, and there will be an incredible amount of, I mean, just star-by-star observations in the local group of clusters. But also integrated field observations of clusters in the Virgo galaxy cluster, and tens of thousands of them. We may have colors and well, it would be nice to have UV actually. This is, I absolutely agree, just because we can see many things. But both is important. But I'm certainly more interested looking in the modeling actually. Yeah.
I'm curious about observations of clusters like what we were talking before. I mean, constraining these intermediate steps that end up with a binary black hole. When you have these dynamical interactions in a cluster, what are the intermediate steps that would help constrain this significantly?
When you still have black holes remaining in the cluster and they're undergoing dynamics, they basically heat the cluster. So they actually keep the overall structure of the cluster very puffy, very not core collapsed. So this was something I always wanted to do with observations, is if you can get detailed surface brightness profiles, it's possible you might be able to get a diagnostic for how many black holes are retained in a cluster at the present day, which, you know, assuming you understand the IMF, should give you some indication of how many you ejected, or how many you have retained versus how many you started with. It would be a good way to sort of map the dynamics.
Are there some dynamic effects?
Yes. So, I mean, IMBHs, sort of. One of the bigger problems I've always thought about is if you have natal kicks, then that's also a very efficient way to get rid of black holes early on. So that would, I mean, basically simulate having a lot of dynamics that also kicked out the black holes very early on. So that's obviously a quick degeneracy.
Okay.
Okay.
Just Carl showed an example of what can happen. I mean, this pass, but this was from the Monte Carlo simulation. I mean, we need them. But the Monte Carlo simulation has only very limited freedom. You know, you have isolated objects and have some random numbers to decide when they make an encounter. When we look in our embody simulations, we find many more things. And in the discussion in the morning, that was alluded to, you know, just question, is this four-body encounters, are there triples? how do these black holes form, and what's their detailed distribution that only we can know from a from an incredibly expensive direct simulation.
I mean, as long as we have a few body integrator in there, I mean, the majority of these encounters and things that get kicked out are binary single and binary encounters. You do form triples, but they're so short-lived and they're so unstable that, I mean, what we found when we just looked at the stability criterion of the triples we did form in the Monte Carlo was that only about 1% of them might form any population of LIGO sources. So, I mean, that is an interesting thing to do, but overall, the statistics of these things, I mean, we're still dealing with a million particles, right? That's close enough to the Fokker-Planck limit for this thing to work. We're on a paper where we showed that it's close enough.
Okay, so it's getting a little technical.
So, following this topic, how often do you form things like X-ray binaries with black holes in globular clusters, and how many should you have in order to for them later for the black holes to form merging binary black holes? So what should be the X-ray? So what should be the X-ray luminosity of a globular cluster?
I mean, we haven't. From what we've seen, there doesn't seem to be much of a correlation between the mass or size of the cluster and the number of X-ray binaries that it forms. We're still looking into this right now, but I mean, a slight. Yeah. 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 So
I think this should be a consistency check that you know we should follow all these populations up until the point where they form binary black holes and make sure that all these X-ray binaries exist in the proper numbers and with proper properties.
Yeah.
Does that become the derivative of the field evolution as well, which we
have in the cluster? Yeah. So, well, I don't know if that was a question to anyone.
The answer is no. The answer is no. They're all dynamically formed. We know that.
So,
because
what?
The number density of these objects per unit mass depends on the collision rate. So we know that all these systems are dynamical and are significantly above the field population. So, the answer
is
two.
Okay. Yeah, Neil, that sounds like a strong constraint.
Yeah. We know almost that every contact binary is the result of mechanical evolution in the system.
Okay. So coffee's not ready yet, so we can go on for a couple of more minutes.
I was also curious about discussing a bit the observational constraints for intermediate phases for the common envelope channel. I mean, like what I was mentioning earlier on observing these red supergiants at distant galaxies at lower metallicity. So I don't know, is it when we get the James Webb, won't we be able to do pretty good constraints on this? Although it's low, short-lived phases, we should be able to go pretty deep, shouldn't we?
Can I answer that question?
No, it's just nothing.
I hope we make more progress in other ways before that.
Yeah.
I think that the crucial objects in this scenario are objects like I hope that IC10X1 or NGC300X1 are. So these are Wolf-Rayet binaries with black holes on short orbits. So these are the objects just after the common envelope and before becoming a binary black hole. So a careful study of new LHCs and looking for orbital periods and identifying the stars and the orbital companions may help here. And the consistency check, okay, you know, by looking at this object and looking at the selection effects, this is a very easy calculation to do a consistency check with the rate and mass spectrum of the observed gravitational wave population. So
in particular with ULXs, I mean, if we have something like the first detection, we have 30 solar mass black holes, so that should be a pretty bright ULX if it went through an accretion phase.
If IC10X1 hosts a 30 solar mass black hole, it is like a progenitor of binary black hole that that we see. So
yeah.
So, there's this controversy over whether it's just due to ionization of the near side of the wind moving the light center.
So I said if.
Is that something we can resolve?
I think this is a very difficult thing to do observationally, as far as I know. But I think that if there is a way to solve it, that would be very important.
I would count this under this low-hanging fruits. I mean, it's not so low.
Put it in quotes.
Asymmetric envelope, but one can do something in this direction. I think this approximates the thing. So I would say the PhD project could do something.
You need to start with.
Actually, from the computational community, I would also look not only for the low-hanging fruit, but for the high-hanging fruit and ask what is needed. I mean, we had a certain reference here to the 3D hydro, 3D stellar evolution. Also, I mean, just million-body, n-body models, nuclear star clusters with 10 to 7 or 10 to 8 stars. It is not a few, but maybe 10 or 100 are needed, and then maybe a few thousand Monte Carlo models. So this kind of thing can be done in 5 years. Maybe we have the exaflop computers, and we have hardware which can do it. But actually, we need to deal with it and be aware that some work maybe needs to be done in the codes. You know, flash. I'm a little bit disappointed from astrophysical community when I see in the n-body community actually a lot has been done for using new technology. But in the hydro community like Flash, Gadget, SPH, actually much too little is done actually. When I was younger actually it was different. We were queuing to get to the most advanced supercomputers and just first maybe for being excited about the new technology, and this is I wonder actually whether in the other fields something can be done in the next 5 years, you know, for these key issues.
Well, I wanted to ask you both if there are problems that you think in massive stellar evolution in which we really need to do, you know, to understand a 3D, you know, a very simple isolated 3D problem that can gain insight into all of these issues that you struggle with. Absolutely. As input parameters. What is your top three list?
I'm not dividing you, but that's exactly what I'm doing. I think that there is definitely a potential for starting to gain some better understanding of the other envelopes of massive stuff. So probably energy transport, MFT, this is something actually we're working on. So trying to understand the stability of radiation-dominated convective regions into massive and very massive stars. So we're getting more of the species we're talking about. From the point of view of internal Angle-Mitton transport, these are also something that can be probably done with better calculation, even box calculation. There's definitely some. There are groups that are trying to tackle this problem. I would say we're closer probably to understand better this than this. Also, I think that.
So, physically, what is the open question in the
At the end, yeah, exactly. So what it is that transports energy in a region where convection is so inefficient it actually cannot carry all the heat flux, and where radiation is actually playing an important role. So radiation instabilities are present. There's like non-steady behavior, pulsation, and potentially feedback to muscles. Actually, those two turn out to be potentially very importantly related. For example, the LV phase.
So to your question, can you answer? From my perspective, the people who went to stellar beings, now it's classical field, yeah, people doing it for 50 years or more. And it was always built the photosphere, photons, and then wind somehow happens, and so winds were always detached from stars, except of luminosity and temperature. And now what I see very exactly, so first of all, it's come from stellar beings. We see all this variability, pulsations, the lines move as crazier, there are, you know, some rotational things. And then now from other side, from people like material with internal structure, and I think maybe in the next 10 years we will witness photosphere wind connections thing or sub-photosphere wind connection thing. And maybe we cannot understand winds and muscles rates unless we look deeper down, we need to know about turbulence below solid point just to predict muscle strains.
So we actually do have those quantities already now. So I think it's going to be earlier than 5 years. And so Lita's point is providing the initial conditions for calculation of wind mass loss in the even in the line-driven regime that come from calculation of the 3D structure of the outer envelopes of stars up to the sonic point.
You wanted to 3D radiation transport with very high frequency resolution.
We just actually need to. They can do the wind, but we can just provide, for example, what's the density fluctuation and velocity fluctuation at the location of the wind acceleration, and they can take it from there.
But you are pushing a lot of this turbulence. You're pushing the limits of what you even trust what the code is doing, right? So if you look at people doing hydrogen shell burning, how much material you scrape and bring down, all of that stuff is hitting what your numerical codes. You don't know if your numerical codes are doing it right. You can do a convergence, and we do these lots of those levels, you do convergence studies on these, and they will get different answers on how much material they scrape up. These are codes that actually do scale on GPU machines or so they actually are using full computing power, we're hitting the edge of what we can do easily with the numerical techniques people are using. If you're using flash, you're well beyond, you're well behind what people are trying. And these are questions that are not, I don't think, are easily answerable without really thinking about their techniques or maybe doing laboratory experiments to test. Although laboratory experiments are going well. Yeah, I think the issue is that we've done convergence studies with lots of codes, we get different answers.
Maybe we can conclude. I would, just as a note on what Chris just said, totally true. For many of the problems that are important, for example, for entrainment, extra mixing or overshooting, those kind of things. I think that for this problem in particular, probably things a little better. We just need to understand the large mode of energy transport, and probably the problem of resolution might impact more things that happen at boundaries of convective regions. There, I agree that we might be a long way toward running like realistic simulation. But I think there are like places where we can advance our knowledge substantially if we focus on picking our battles right.
So you completely skip the internal mixing when discussing computational low-hanging fruits?
Yeah, because of this reason, because it's not low-hanging. But I think that there is a little bit of interplay between these two. I mean, so I think internal angular momentum transport we'll have to kind of guide a little bit our understanding of internal mixing. I think,
if we know already that there is, so okay, they're decoupled some level, but might be a lot of mechanism that transport angular mean to also transport species. And I think that we need to, this student need to talk, and I think that that's where we might gain some information and knowledge.
So just if the stars that are deformed because the companion is so nearby, no longer are axisymmetric, so they're teardrop shaped, you have some idea what elephant streams are doing in axisymmetric flows. If you take out this axisymmetric part, is there anything feasible there in that direction to at least say whether it's more or less reasonable?
I see this is a problem of time scales. I mean, the time scale for any circulation is pretty long. You need to solve dynamical time scales because you have horizontal turbulence and a whole host of other processes that operate on much shorter time scales. So I think that's one thing that causes that particular problem to be a very high answer.
I wanted to ask, I think we I think the
3D and calculate these large scale flows, and you will essentially do what the Geneva people have been doing. So,
okay. I think that I just got an email that cookies and coffee are served, so you should take the conversation to.
Thank you. That's all.